The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, Jonathan Swift's savage indignation.
His commitment was to mental health. He had views, this fierce indignation was because he had views that today we would take for granted. This is 300 years ago. He believed Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet and Dr. Merryman were the best doctors in the land.
The extraordinary life and myriad legacies of the great satirist and humanitarian. And coming up a little later, the mass hunger strike of 1923.
After about 14th or 15th day, we didn't go round much. We stayed in bed a lot, conserving energy and read books. And above all, read any book that had a lot about food in it. We loved that.
We'll hear about the anti-treaty and Cumann na mBan members who were incarcerated, one of the many stories covered in the extensive new book, The Atlas of the Irish Civil War. Jonathan Swift is best known as one of the greatest satirists in English literature, celebrated for works like Gulliver's Travels and A Modest Proposal. But his legacy extends far beyond his literary genius. As we'll hear tonight, he was a pioneer in fields like finance and also mental health care, bequeathing in his will the money to establish what is now St Patrick's University Hospital, the leading institution in mental health care today. And we're looking at Swift's life this evening, just in time for the upcoming Jonathan Swift Festival, which runs from the 22nd to the 27th of November, with events taking place around Dublin City. And one of the venues is St Patrick's Cathedral, which will host on Friday, the 22nd of November, Jonathan Swift, Savage Indignation, the life of Jonathan Swift told through interviews, drama and music. That's written and presented by Jerry Mullins, who joins me now. Also featured will be two other Swifties, different application of the name than normal, who are also with me in studio. Dr. Brendan Toomey is an historian and retired banker, and Professor Jim Lucy, Inspector of Mental Health Services at the Mental Health Commission. You're all very welcome indeed
to the History Show.
Jerry, there were two women, I'm sure there were plenty more, but two in particular in his life, both of whom were actually called Esther, but they're known by their names, Stella, or the names Stella and Vanessa, and you've learnt an awful lot about them in the last few months. Tell me about these two women and his relationship with them. Let's start with Stella.
Well, Stella was just a child when Swift met her, and he became her tutor. And from that initial connection, when they both lived in the same house in London, they ended up having a very, very long relationship, about 30 years. So it sounds a bit strange to kind of end up in a very long relationship with somebody you met when they were nine, but there's no suggestion of any impropriety in that situation. But to their friends all around them, everyone assumed that they were married, at least their closest friends did. But it begs the question, why did they not declare that they were married? And the current thinking is that they were actually very closely related in a very way that would cause them both embarrassment. In other words, it seems, we don't know for certain, it seems that both of them, their parentage were questionable, and they may have been uncle and niece. And it might have been at an advanced stage of the relationship before they found this out. So they developed a very, very close friendship. They wrote to each other all the time. One of Swift's most famous publications is actually called Letters to Stella. Mm. So when he was over working for the Conservative, first of all, he's worked with the Whigs. Later on, he worked with the Conservative government in England.
And he was a spin doctor.
He was a spin doctor. Yeah. Yes, he was the Alistair Campbell of his day. Very highly regarded.
Absolutely.
And feared. And that's why Lord Bolingbroke hired him in, because he was originally a Whig, and then Bolingbroke brought him in as a Tory. And he admitted, we were afraid of you. We were afraid of your pen. So all those years he was in London, Stella was back here in Dublin, and he was writing to her constantly. And those letters eventually were formed and they were published, and it was called Letter to Stella. Now, he didn't publish it, I should say, you know.
So it wasn't, you don't think it was a platonic relationship?
I don't. Now, nobody has got definitive proof in it, but I don't know if you can possibly be that close to somebody for so long and write these really nice poems to each other, very affectionate poems. It's hard to imagine. I mean, even if it was platonic, it was certainly a very close relationship that didn't really have room for a third person in it.
Ah, but there was.
The plot thickens.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Now tell us about Vanessa.
Right. So Vanessa. So while he was in London and Stella was in Dublin, sure, you know, a fella might get a bit lonely, right? And he befriended this family, and he actually became friendly with Mrs. von Homrig. This is a family that had originally lived in Dublin because the father of the family was actually a Lord Mayor of Dublin. They were a Dutch family. And when the father died, they ended up back living in England, and Swift became friendly with them. And he became friendly with the mother, the widow, in a platonic way. And I think more like a mother-son relationship. You know, she used to cook for him, and he used to leave his good wig and his good gown in the house. And you can imagine, even to this day, a bachelor living in a strange city, they kind of gravitate towards wherever they can get a free meal. And that was the relationship as it started off with Stella, because Stella was the daughter. She was still a teenager when this older gentleman was coming in to change his gown and change his wig and get a free dinner. And from there, a relationship started, which, again, like the one with Stella, was kind of a tutor-pupil relationship. He was very kind to her, very helpful to her, guided her. And from there, some kind of a relationship developed such that she thought that she would be marrying him. I think we can be fairly clear about that.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Yeah. She expected. She also became a poet. Her verse is not bad, which is amazing for a woman at that time, with the privations that education would have existed, you know, would have limited a woman's access to education. So he clearly was somebody worthwhile being around because he shared his knowledge. And so a woman was emancipated by him.
I completely agree. Could you imagine having Jonathan Swift as your personal tutor?
Yeah, I'd love that. That'd be great.
The cleverest man in the kingdom. That's what they say.
Yeah. So, as I said there, Jim, like, I've been going through Stella's poems, and they really are really nice. I've converted them to songs. We'll probably talk about that shortly. Vanessa's prose is really strong. Mm. When Vanessa writes a lacerating letter at you, you feel it.
Yeah. Right? You know all about it. That's very true.
There was nothing held back.
But I mean, he did not necessarily share Vanessa's feelings towards him, or did he? Or
I think in London, the relationship was quite strong, and he was many years in London, and they were many years together in London. The problem started when he moved back to Dublin. He lost his job, like any spin doctor. Once the government changes, you lose your job. Almost within hours, right? Mm. So he lost his job. He took a consolation prize, which was the Dean of St. Patrick's. He didn't want a deanery of St. Patrick's. He didn't really want to come back to Ireland. He was hoping for maybe a similar position in England. That would have suited him down to the ground. But anyway, he was sent back to...
He was lucky to get it. Of the Bolingbroke conspiracy, or they had been governed, went to the Tower. So he just had to go to Dublin.
True. Well,
if you remember, because he had done such great service, the pun was, we have to get a lean bishopric or a fat deanery for Dr. Swift. They were unashamed in their use of preferment, to use their euphemism. Yes.
But just let's get back to the sex and the romance.
Okay, enough of this religion.
Vanessa decides that,
she's coming
Johnny,
back. Well.
Johnny's back in Dublin. Yeah. I'm heading there as well.
Yeah. Now, there's various reasons for it. It was to do with her inheritance. She had to come here because the inheritance that she was due to get a big wad of cash. And the family owned a big, beautiful house in Selbridge called Selbridge Abbey, which is still there. Still a big, beautiful house, but it's kind of closed up. Mm. So she was from a rich family and she was due to inherit. And things were getting a bit messy back in Dublin. So she did have to come for that reason.
Right.
And she didn't really want to be in Dublin either. But he wrote to her, and it's quite clear in some of the letters, if you come to Dublin, I will see you seldom. He didn't want her to come, and she came anyway. And that then set the scene for a problem that was eventually going to arise, and it did arise.
How did that, Brendan, how did that all work itself out, the relationship with these two women who were both in Ireland at the same time as he was?
Well, it's very hard to say in some respects. As Jerry says, Swift said, I won't see you often. But clearly they did see one another quite a good deal when in those years. So you're talking 1714 to 1722 for this period. It's a long time. Mm. And they did see one another regularly, a bit surreptitiously. The back room of a bookshop is mentioned on more than one occasion.
How aware was each of the other?
Apparently Stella was not aware, certainly at the beginning.
Of Vanessa.
Vanessa was obviously aware because everybody knew that Stella was, in inverted commas, the mistress of the house. When Swift was in his deanery and was holding a dinner party, Stella would be there doing the hostess duty. But she never stayed there.
And was there not a tabloid press in those days who would have been interested in the comings and goings of the Dean of St. Patrick, particularly a Dean of St. Patrick who was very political?
He was the tabloid press.
That's true.
He had the pen.
Well, there was a couple of things. Stella had her pal with her, Rebecca.
Yeah.
And so the two of them were always together. So the cover was that she was really there with her friend Rebecca. She didn't live with the dean. They were certainly good friends. And also the dean would have said, and everybody would have assumed, they were never alone together. Mm-hmm. It was never Stella and the dean in the room at the same time. I don't really believe it.
Rebecca was the gooseberry.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
So it was totally respectable to have this woman hanging around with another woman. If she was just hanging around the dean, it might be seen as being a different thing.
Mm. Or if she stayed overnight.
Or if she stayed overnight. Yeah. Or if she's known to have stayed overnight.
Yes.
But the thing is, they did stay in the deanery when he was away. Mm. Because like everybody else at the time, they rented rooms. Mm, yeah. And so he saved them a few bob. He says, you can have my gaff when I'm away. But the second I'm back, you're out.
Yeah. If you follow the money, Brendan, you find the money. Yeah.
Jerry, this seems to be very, very unpromising material for a musical. But somehow you have managed to scrape a musical together out of this called Jonathan Swift, Savage Indignation. I mean, is there any point in asking you, looking at the cast list, for example, because Vanessa's there, Stella's there and Swift is there, what the musical is about?
I think we've described, we've given away half the story already. Okay. Well, I do the
Oberyn Ashke, we've done it. Yeah, okay, let's actually hear a snippet of what you can explain the origins of the title of the song and some of the lyrics. A snippet of one of the songs in the musical now. It's called Dash, Dash, Dash.
In London, you wrote pamphlets and letters, often in secret, so police couldn't see. Your fate for your works, your fabulous words, they matter. Accept the words that matter most to me. Dash, 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 just say what you want to say. Dash, 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 please write what I want to see. No secretive code, like sipping my coffee. Please write words that mean something to me.
Right, that was Aisling Coleman as Vanessa, accompanied by David Munro on piano, singing Dash, 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 written by Jerry Mullins. Explain the significance of the dashes.
Mm. Well, can I say, first of all, that's a world premiere. I'd like to congratulate the history show. You know, I'm reminded of when Chris de Burgh played his song for the first time in the Late Show.
It started on the history show.
Exactly. So Swift was an incredibly secretive person. As we said earlier on, the two ladies in his life, their names were Esthers, but one he calls Stella and the other he calls Vanessa. And in his letters, he signs them off Cad to Vanessa. So he had these letters between Vanessa and Cad, neither of whom actually existed as people, you know, as people today, but not their names. So he was incredibly secretive. He was always afraid that his letters would be intercepted and find their way into the press. But also he felt his archbishop was opening his mail. So they had their secret code, and whenever they wanted to say something that was a little bit controversial, a little bit sexy or raunchy, they'd just write dash, dash, dash. And on top of that, sipping my...
And were you meant to guess what the dash, dash, dash suggested, or did it actually mean something?
No, there's no doubt. You could fill in the gaps. Yeah, right. The gaps, context gives you the
gap. Wish I was there to walk around your guard 20 times and then... Dash, dash, dash. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, we get
and,
it. Yeah.
And on top of that, then, they had another few phrases that were kind of part of a secret code. And the coffee kept coming up in the most arbitrary places, you know. I wish I was there with you right now, sipping your coffee. I've had no coffee since I last met you.
How could anybody have thought for 200 years that this might have been a platonic relationship?
Well, that's a good question. Now, I should point out, a lot of their letters weren't published for the first time until about 1921, if I remember correctly. So that's part of it. So anyway, so the couple of verses you just heard being sung by Aisling Coleman. So in London, he wrote pamphlets and letters, often in secret so police wouldn't see. Well, we know that the police were often hounding him. And at one stage, one of his printers got locked up in the tower, you know. And so that's when we get to dash, 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 just say what you want to say, dash, 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 just write what I want to see. No secretive code like sipping my coffee or sipping your coffee. Please write something to you. It means something to me. Can you imagine the frustration? You're dealing with one of the greatest writers in the world who's writing to you regularly. And this man who's been so controversial and he's slaying all his political opponents and other opponents right throughout the world, you know, with his words. And yet when it comes to writing you a love letter...
Dash.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Voltaire writes to Swift, not the other way around.
Absolutely. You know, that's right.
That's how famous he was.
Okay, let's stop the boring sex and romance and move on to more important elements of this, of the story of Jonathan Swift. Jim, his greatest legacy, in your view, is St. Patrick's.
It's certainly up there. It's not a footnote, as you know, Robbins or others would have said, a footnote to the history of healthcare. You know, really, just a sideshow among one of the greatest figures of English literature. It's much more than that. If you think of him as the man, let's say, leave the work aside. This man's he was a contemporary of people. You know, Bishop Berkeley, whose name has been taken off Trinity College because of his commitment to slavery. Swift, commitment to human rights. This is way ahead. And not just in a sort of a smoked salmon way, you know, away but in a practical way in which he was determined to deliver the proceeds of his views and of his talent to the service of other in this case, other Irishmen and women. This was completely unprecedented. And so it is a pioneering thing to do. So I think a first is worthwhile mentioning. Mm. You know, this has not been done before. Now, he was with a group of people, Bishop Delaney, Dr. Stevens, you know, Grizel Stevens, you know, Bartholomew Moss. There was this extraordinary moment of great ascendancy figures who were contributing to human rights and to human. They mightn't have used the word human rights, but they certainly were Lockean. They were followers of that. They were not the believers of the brutal, nasty and short theory of what humanity was about. So he stands out amongst them, but within them he even stands out because his commitment was to mental health. Mm. So this fierce indignation was because he had views that today we would take for granted. This is 300 years ago. He believed Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet and Dr. Merryman were the best doctors in the land. This is an invention of holistic healthcare that we think is as recent as last year. But no, 300 years ago, he was taking exercise. He was washing. He was entreating people to eat vegetables, to limit the amount of red meat. This is a really...
He himself consumed some pretty exotic fruits, didn't he?
He liked fruits. We mentioned the coffee. Of course, we're at a time now when of course, trade is opening up. These things were coming into Dublin and into London. So you could get coffee and you could get fine fruits and things. That hadn't been the case before. So there was that sense of being on the world stage. He also was committed to being in amongst the powerful. Cum magnus vix esse. He was prepared to sit with the great and to negotiate with them. And he made that the motto of his life. And it references Erasmus, the great figures of the Renaissance. He saw himself at that level. But his purpose was for the human good. And he wasn't stuffy about it. If there was a table, you know, that old party game, who would you like to have for dinner with you? I want Swift. And everybody who knows me knows that. Yeah. I want Swift to come to dinner. Because he would have been wonderfully entertaining. He might have been savagely indignant, but he'd have been right on the right side of the argument.
And he would have made sure you washed your hands before.
He would have made sure you washed before and afterwards. And he would have taken exercise and been fit. He might have walked to the dinner in the sense that no one else thought that those with mental affliction were worth any time. They were subhuman. He was remarkable. He argued this, though, from first principles. He says, you say the mentally ill are mad because they hold fixedly things that are false. But which of us does not hold fixedly things that are false? We all believe things to be true that are not. Therefore, the mentally ill are no different than us. This was an emancipation of enormous proportion. Now, the fact that he then did another thing, Miles, he said, and he predicted it, he said he'd going to do it. He wasn't a spin doctor of falsehood. He spun, but he said in his own epitaph, you know, he said in the past tense, but in fact it was in the future tense, he gave all the wealth he had. Now, it turns out, to build a home for fools and mad, that was the term, and prove
no kingdom, no nation needed so much. He had a national sense of Ireland. He's the first patriot, in a sense. He saw Ireland as a nation. And he saw the commitment to their afflicted as being the mark of a nation.
And did it have anything to do? Because, I mean, I always assumed that, and utterly naive, I know, and idiotic, but that's the reason why he contributed so much to St. Patrick's Hospital was because he went mad himself.
No, this
no,
is...
nothing to do with it.
No, no. His successors... After all, after Queen Anne's gone, the Georgians come. It's very, very important that this man, who is really destructive, is diminished and is marginalised. And in fact, his commitment to mental illness is something that stigmatically happens even now. You know, we can dismiss him. He was no. His commitment was born out of experience. Certainly, he was orphaned. His love of comfort, the comfort company of women, is very understandable for me as a psychiatrist. You know, there people took him in, and he was committed to it because of his experience in the Bedlam Hospital. He had been to the Bedlam Hospital in London, where he was a chaplain. The Bedlam was not a hospital. It was a zoo where those who were demented or deranged in some way were put on show. You paid to throw things at them. He was chaplain to those people. He saw that this was the wrong way. He had a deeply authentic commitment to mental illness.
One of the fascinating things about him also, Brendan, is the way you've looked at his finances and the way in which this hospital was financed, I think, is quite extraordinary. But tell us about how he went about making money.
Well, two things. Firstly, the hospital, as Jim says, everybody knew that that hospital was on the way because he first announces it over 10 years before he dies. Well, about 1731, 32. It's regularly reported in the papers as he's getting it organised, putting the governors together. Now, how did he pay for it? Well, his will, he left £15,000 to the hospital. The rest of his will is just incidentals. You know, my favourite coat to this person, two medals to that person, etc. including some jokes. My second favourite hat, you know, sort of thing. But in those days, the Dean of St. Patrick's, they don't have a salary. They have rents and incomes to the person who has the job. That's why none of them retire. They die with their boots on. It's worth about £700 a year. That's, technically speaking, a shed load of money. That is 40 times the average industrial wage, in inverted commas. He was a good saver. He literally saved a third of his income. He gave away a third of his income and he spent a third of his income in round numbers. So by the time he dies, he has a fortune of £15,000. Now, it's not bank account. It's not gold coins. It's not shares. The bulk of it is a secured person-to-person loan on a mortgage on land. There are three major ones, and all three, if I could put my bank manager's hat on for a moment, are bad credit risks. They are not doing very, very well. If the inspectors came in nowadays, he would be dismissed as a lender, and the central bank would say you have to put more capital in to make sure that you can take the losses, you know, etc., etc. The last of the money that he bequeathed, the hospital got it in 1805. He died in 1745. It took them a long time to get their money back. But they did in the end. They didn't get all the interest. They got the capital back, but they didn't quite earn the interest on it. So that's where the money went. He had appointed a set of governors and they got on with the job. The building starts, Jim, you'd probably know this better than me, only about 4 years after he died.
Only 4 years. Yeah. And I think it was really public sentiment was so great. Yeah. Dean Craddock was his successor, could not leave this undone. Mm-hmm. It had been talked about for so long and they knew the fortune was there. And so it had to be done. And the compromises were made, as you know. But a huge achievement.
Yeah. The reason we know all of this, of course, is because the governors of the hospital got all the paperwork to do with his finances. And that's where I've been using to explore.
Tremendous resource.
It is tremendous resource.
He was very specific about where he wanted the hospital to be located and also how it should be run, Jim. Mm.
Yes, he had
the bylaws were set up even before he died.
Bylaws were set up, many of which, and I'll come to one of them that is always amused me, but the hospital ran by, you know, when we achieved independence, all these had to be changed just by charter. But that was all. The content would stay the same. He was very concerned about the site. The Dublin burghers were very keen to make him commit the money to the building of it in Smithfield, where the Bluecoat School went. And he wasn't happy with that site.
And so he never agreed on an ideal site. Dr. Stevens and Griselda, who was alive then, gave to the developers the site, which is at the back of Dr. Stevens Hospital. It's on a slope, it's on the Camac, it was a malarial swamp. It's just not a good place to be. Now it turns out to be the ideal place to have a mental health service that serves the city. It is smack bang in the community, by a train, by, you know, by the Lewis. But on the other hand, at that stage, it was a very poor plot within the Liberties. And so they had to make compromises. They built the corridors for the Collini and the Bugley parallel, whereas traditionally, subsequently, they would have been out with each other. He laid down charters that were very much of their time, but they were hugely wise. One of the ones that used to always amuse us, and occasionally I'd be reminded of it in jest, was that the director of medicine, or it wouldn't have been called that, the chief clinician of some kind, should not form too close a personal relationship with the director of nursing.
Very wise.
Very wise. Yeah. And this is a man who knew the goings on with coffee in the back room of a library. And yes, he understood that these things happened in hospitals. And he was tremendously generous and humane. Mm. He never lost the practical realities of human beings.
But there's one other element to it. He was a churchman.
Yes.
And yet he wanted this hospital to be non-sectarian.
He was a church. He gave the lands that became the Foundling Hospital. That's James's. He gave the lands that became the Meath Hospital.
That's right.
It was his vineyard. Mm. And that became the county hospital. Mm. He was extremely concerned that this should not be, and he laid it down. So they couldn't, for example, if you compare the Rotunda, which is another wonderful legacy of philanthropy and national patriotism from Bartholomew Moss, it has in the centre of it a chapel. Everybody to visit Dublin should go and see it, with the ornate ceiling and the magnificent bas relief. There is none of this in Patrick's. Why? He did not want it to be a sectarian hospital. It was to be open to everyone. This is visionary. Mm. Now, he was a little bit iffy about Presbyterians. He was
more than a little bit.
Everybody likes, everybody who likes Swift minimises foibles. He described Presbyterians as fanatics, but they still were admitted. If they needed to be. Unfortunately, his vision was never realised. Within months of the hospital opening, the financial model, which depended on realising all these monies, was not sustained. And so they started taking paid patients.
Just to talk about Brendan, his relationship, I mean, he didn't particularly want to come back to Ireland. Yeah. He was comfortable in London. But then how does that square with one of the most famous quotes that everybody knows from Swift? Ireland would never be happy till a law were made for burning everything that came from England except their people and their coals. And I think subsequently he says that, and I'm not so sure about the first one.
Yeah.
Or words to that effect. So what was his relationship with England?
Well, first of all, he's a satirist. You know, Swift is always good fun that way. I always say to students and people, read the sentence before and the sentence after. It's always good advice. When he came back to Dublin, he says, you know, in a forlorn hope, he says, and I am never going to get involved in Irish politics. He says this in 1714. And he keeps his word for about 5 years.
Mm.
And he comes out eventually with the Irish Manufacturers, which has that famous quote, which gets his printer into trouble. Because what we've got to recognise is, in our internet age, that was anonymous.
Mm.
But everybody knew who wrote it.
Mm.
So the only way...
As was Drapier's Letters, correct, which was about Woods Apens, also anonymous.
And Draper was one of his pseudonyms. Everybody knew.
Yeah. But the only way the government could get after somebody is by arresting the printer. So the printer gets arrested. Waters in the first case, Harding in the second. And shall we say the judge tries to strong arm the jury into convicting. And the burghers of Dublin, the brave burghers, 9 times they are sent out to come back with a guilty verdict, and 9 times they come back and say, no, we can't see any guilty verdict here. That was in 1720. The reason Swift gets so upset is a thing called the Declaratory Act, which is where the British government get tired of what they called independency in the Irish political elite. And they enact an act, 294 words. They don't waste any words in it. And they simply say, we're the boss, and the British House of Lords is the only place you can go to have an appeal.
Yeah.
Swift hated this. That was the proximate cause for writing the Manufacturers. So he and his mates were spoiling for a fight, and along comes Wood.
where they're going to issue all this copper coin to Ireland. The main issue is nobody consulted them. So they had this fit of high indignation. And to be fair, Swift isn't the leader of the campaign. Many of his colleagues are the leaders. Swift joins it about halfway through it with the Drapier's letters. The word Drapier is, I always believe, a Dublinism.
Mm.
Because when you look up the sources, the word never appears before 1724. The proper word is Draper. So he issues the letters and we have a repeat performance of 1720. Their printer gets arrested.
Mm.
There's another court case.
Mm.
But they win. In fact, there are three Drapier's letters that were not published at the time. We were at a seminar only recently where we were discussing that. They were only published about 10 years later because they didn't need to be published at the time because the campaign worked.
Was he, though, a progressive? I mean, we think of him because of all this political activity as being a very progressive figure. Mm. Was he progressive?
Can I be my word of German on this? Jein, ja und nein.
Mm.
On some things, yes. On other things, no. My view is that over time he becomes more progressive, the more he reflects on these things,
mm.
The more he looks at the colonialism issue, the stronger his anti-colonial texts become.
And the more he looks at the poverty around him.
Indeed.
Exactly.
Part of that, well, as you know, then that gives you the modest proposal in 1729. And he's casting this against his own type, his own tribe, because it's the landlords that are racking the rent. As he puts it in the modest proposal, he basically says, well, sure, they might as well have the children. They've got everything else.
And fricassee them, sell them to the Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great joke.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think progressive is interesting. He absolutely is progressive, in my view. I'll give you two areas where he is. One is in religion. The three men in the tub are the three leaders of the great religions.
Yeah.
And in Gulliver, the pomposity, the self-righteousness, the phoniness of the educational and political leaders of the time is
shown
up.
The big Endians and the little Endians.
Yeah.
They're all shown up. And then in terms of his commitment to the mentally ill, that's a really, really remarkably progressive thing. Mm. Unprecedented and unparalleled since then. You could say Henry Hutchinson Stuart gave a great deal and was a great philanthropist 100 years later. But no philanthropist in the history of Ireland, no rich person has given all the wealth they had to a cause such as the mentally ill.
Okay. All of this and a lot more, I'm sure, will be teased out during the Jonathan Swift Festival, which runs from the 22nd to the 27th of November with events around Dublin City. Go to jonathanswiftfestival.ie for more information. And the event Jonathan Swift Savage Indignation takes place at St. Patrick's Cathedral on Friday, the 22nd of November at 8 p.m. You can hear all of our guests and you can hear that song dash, dash, dash all over again. It's the life of Jonathan Swift told through interviews, drama and music, presented by Jerry Mullins and featuring interviews with Jim and Brendan, as well as Cathy Scuffle, and music from the choir of St. Patrick's Cathedral. So to my guests this evening, Jim Lucy, Brendan Toomey and Jerry Mullins, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Miles.
Thank you. Thank you.
And after the break, we'll be opening up the Atlas of the Irish Civil War. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. The Irish Civil War came to an end in May of 1923, but after the conflict, thousands of anti-treaty IRA and Cumann na mBan members remained incarcerated in various prisons and camps. In the months following the war, those prisoners became increasingly agitated by their continued detention. They eventually joined forces in a mass hunger strike aimed at securing their release. The story of those hunger strikers is one of many explored in the new book, The Atlas of the Irish Civil War. In this report, Ian Kennelly talks to one of the book's editors, historian Dr. Helene O'Keefe.
The men decided that there were 15,000 at that time interned for no reason, good, bad or indifferent, and that they couldn't go on with that forever. And the conditions were very, very bad in both Kilmainham and Mountjoy, and they decided they'd go on a hunger strike and end one way or another.
That was Sheila Humphreys in a clip from the RTE archive speaking about the mass hunger strike of October and November 1923. Humphreys from Limerick was a prominent member of Cumann na mBan who'd been active throughout the War of Independence, working as a courier and as an organiser. She opposed the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921 and was arrested in November 1922 when National Army forces raided her family home in Dublin, a raid in which they captured Ernie O'Malley, who had been using the house as both a headquarters and a hideout. Like thousands of others, Humphreys remained a prisoner even after the end of the Civil War when she would, then aged 24, take part in the mass hunger strike. The background to that strike is described by Dr. Helene O'Keefe, who has written about those remarkable events in the Atlas of the Irish Civil War.
Incredibly, in some ways, given that it was the largest hunger strike in Irish history, including about 8,000 prisoners at its height, it's one of the lesser known aspects of the Irish Civil War. Certainly, it began 6 months after the formal end of hostilities, but its roots were firmly planted in that conflict, so much so that it's been described as the Civil War's final act. By October 1923, there were about 10,000 Republicans still held in Free State prisons and detention camps across the country, including 86 female prisoners in the North Dublin Union. The figure had actually been closer to about 12,000 in July, but many had been released because of their relative unimportance or because of their willingness to sign a pledge or an undertaking renouncing anti-government militarism.
The Cumannaghwale government under W.T. Cosgrave was wary of a renewal of violence and reluctant to sanction the release of those who had opposed the state through force of arms. On the other side, the prisoners were angered not only by their seemingly indefinite incarceration, but also by the poor conditions in which they were being held. Conditions that, as Helene explains, led a group of prisoners in Mountjoy to begin a mass hunger strike.
The strike began in Mountjoy at midnight on the 13th of October 1923, and it spread sporadically and importantly without coordination or direction to other sites of detention. As striker Paddy O'Donnell put it, no one was ordered on it, but no one felt they could stay off it. After 10 days, the Mountjoy strikers were joined by internees in the sprawling Tintown camp in the Curra, Hare Park, Gormanstown Park, Newbridge Barracks, Kilkenny, Dundalk and Cork jails, and 51 women in the North Dublin Union. More prisoners in Tralee and Castlebar and on board the prison ship Argenta in Belfast would soon follow suit. The surge of enrolment was exhilarating, but such an uncoordinated mass protest was absolutely unsustainable.
At least some of the prisoners had doubts about their own ability to carry through with the strike. Ernie O'Malley was one, fearing the prolonged hunger that lay ahead. Another prisoner to leave a recollection of those events was Paddy O'Donnell. At the time, O'Donnell from Donegal was 30 years old and a veteran of the War of Independence. He opposed the Anglo-Irish Treaty and was captured in the forecourts at the start of the Civil War, spending the entirety of that conflict as a prisoner. In this clip from the RTE archives, he describes being on hunger strike in 1923.
It didn't seem to have any particular... I was lean and hard to kill and was walking around when other people had collapsed. And the feeling of hunger is a pretty terrible experience. But the extraordinary thing about it was that while one was very hungry and when one fell asleep, you dreamt of feeds. Yet at the same time, when the food, which the governor was found it necessary to deliver by according to the rules, when that was pushed in the door, you would no more think of taking the food than of eating the leg of the table. It was as though you pulled a steel grid across, and that was that. Now, you can't play act on a hunger strike. You either just do it or you don't.
The anti-treaty IRA hunger strikers were also joined by Cumannamon prisoners in the North Dublin Union. They were divided amongst themselves as to whether a hunger strike was justified or likely to succeed, but urged on by Sheila Humphreys and others, over 50 agreed to take part. Humphreys recalls her experiences in a clip from the RTE archives.
Well, after about the 14th or 15th day, we didn't go round much. We stayed in bed a lot, conserving energy, and read books. And above all, read any book that had a lot about food in it. We loved that. And we had one wonderful girl from Cork. I think Marie O'Brien, I think was her name. She wrote down to her sister to send up her best cookery book. She was on hunger strike. And every day at about lunch hour, she'd say, "Now, girls, we're going to have a four-course lunch." And she'd read out first hors d'oeuvre or soup or something and go through the whole thing.
The women hunger strikers provided the government with a challenge. Many of the Cumannamon prisoners, including Humphreys, had gone on hunger strike during the Civil War, winning concessions from a government that was wary of the negative publicity surrounding such cases. In the face of a mass hunger strike, however, the government was unwilling to be seen to grant concessions, and so, according to Humphreys, the prison authorities took an alternate, although duplicitous, approach.
We were 15 days on strike when a message was sent round that we were all to be released that day. The women were all being released. And they said, did we want to order taxis? Did we want to, what time would we like to go? And so on. And my aunt was in with me at the time in the North Dublin Union, and we decided we'd be home in time for the evening meal so that we'd get the taxi at 5 or 6. That was grand. Everything was great. They started making tea in every one of the dormitories and all the different tea. And they asked me, as well, I said, I've been so long now, I think I'd wait till I get home. I'd rather. And my aunt said the same, unfortunately. And at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, word came back from the gate that only those who had broken their fast would be allowed out. In other words, only those who had taken tea. And of course, nearly all had taken tea. And it was a trick so that they could say in the papers next day, the women have given in. And so here we were, had to go back again. And we were 15 days that time, and we didn't get out till we were 31 days in hunger strike.
By the end of those 31 days, only 8 of the women prisoners remained on hunger strike. A similar pattern was replayed in other prisons and camps as the strike lost momentum.
In most cases, the reality of extreme deprivation quickly eroded resolve. Morale was also sapped by the government's continued commitment to the phased release of prisoners who agreed to sign the pledge, and the absence of that really important cross-sectional support that had buoyed those famous hunger strikers in Mountjoy in April 1920. More and more peeled off, and by mid-November, only a hardcore of about 200 prisoners were still refusing food. Petitions, resolutions, letters fell on deaf ministerial ears. Cosgrave's government was unwilling to yield to the absolutist demands of the prisoners, unwilling to undermine those hardline decisions that they had made during the Civil War. They remained steadfast even after two prisoners succumbed to the effects of more than 35 days on hunger strike. Dennis Barry died of heart failure in the Curragh Hospital on the 20th of November, followed 2 days later by Mountjoy striker Andy O'Sullivan.
Their deaths occurred during a period in which the anti-treaty leadership decided to take the remaining protesters off the hunger strike. The deaths of Barry and O'Sullivan may have played a part in that decision, but as Lean O'Keefe explains, other factors were also involved.
An intervention by Cardinal Michael Logue actually proved influential in bringing the protest to a close. In a letter read aloud at Masses in his Archdiocese in Armagh on the 18th of November, he appealed for a compromise. He asked the strikers to abandon the dangerous and unlawful strike and urged the government to release the remaining, quote, untried and unconvicted prisoners. And this eased the decision by the strike leadership, who'd been transferred to Kilmainham, to call off the strike on humanitarian grounds after 41 days.
The strike ended without any guarantees from the government that the prisoners would be released. Ernie O'Malley, who had been moved from Mountjoy to Kilmainham during his 41-day strike, stated that we had been defeated again. Yet the government, having broken the strike, authorised more prisoner releases in a process that would continue into the following year.
In the weeks before Christmas, all of the women and most of the male prisoners were released in phases. And this was the final phase, the government insisted, of a process that had begun 6 months before, and as such, reflective of the futility of the Republican last stand. But the requirement to sign the form was quietly abandoned, and the speed of the releases really spoke to the official urgency to clear the prisons, to return to a kind of a normality.
According to the Atlas of the Irish Civil War, at least 6 more prisoners died as a result of the effects of hunger strike at late 1923 and early 1924. and sources such as the military service pensions files speak of a longer-term physical and psychological effect for many others. The hunger strikers may have failed to achieve their goals, but the sheer scale of the protest provided ample proof of the animosities that divided the Free State.
That was Ian Kennedy reporting there from Cork, where he learned about the mass hunger strike of 1923. That's one of the many subjects documented in the Atlas of the Irish Civil War, recently published by Cork University Press and edited by Elaine O'Keefe, John Crowley, Donal O'Driscoll, John Borgonovo and Mike Murphy. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme, and indeed all we've time for on this series of The History Show. We'll be back in the spring with another run of episodes. Until then, you can catch up on all our episodes at rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye, and thanks for listening.